I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle's a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. Today we're going to be talking about Easter. We're coming to you on Easter weekend. We actually are releasing this episode on Good Friday, which you can't say Happy Good Friday. That's not a thing. So a good somber Good Friday to you.
Yeah, you too, man.
Thanks.
I'm okay with saying Happy Easter. Some of those people out there think you're not supposed to experience Easter until like 5 a.m. Sunday morning.
Yeah.
I'm not that person.
No.
So Happy Easter.
And screw Holy Saturday. well, yes. And we know that many of you, most of you don't listen to this episode as soon as we drop them. So it was Good Friday for those of you who are listening some other time, but it's Easter weekend and we wanted to talk about the resurrection.
Yep.
We've talked about the resurrection in spots here and there, and we've had a consistent theme through the middle of our podcast talking about if the resurrection didn't happen, would you still be a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to that in this episode, but we're going to kind of take a shotgun approach to this episode. We have a number of thoughts about the resurrection. Some of them are fun. Some of them annoy me, and they're all fun and good. And we're just going to just literally bounce around and talk about whether the resurrection really happened. What if the resurrection didn't happen? We're going to talk about what the resurrection means to us and what this conversation does to us in many ways. So
yeah.
I'm excited about it. I mean, the resurrection, if it's real, if it happened, it's the biggest deal of all time in the history of the universe.
Yeah. Yeah, most of our episodes have a clear theme and a through line, and then we try to, you know, stick to that and bring everything back. This doesn't really, other than it's about resurrection, so we're not even going to pretend otherwise. This is very much all the questions we have about resurrection shoved into one conversation, which, and we're not going to get to the bottom of any of them,
no.
But that's fine.
And hopefully we get to some of our listeners' questions.
Most likely these are things, you know, a thoughtful Christian is going to wonder about some of these things, and so we're going to wonder along with you for 45 minutes to an hour.
Yeah. And what we do around here, we say this every episode, but we always know that we have new listeners. And if you're new, welcome to the community. We're excited to have you, excited you're listening. Hope you go back and listen to old episodes and either get really excited or hate our guts, whatever it is.
Yeah.
We love you.
Regardless. Write reviews either way because we need reviews.
Yes. Amen. But what we do around here, we are a pastor and a philosopher walk into a bar. And we like to have conversations around alcoholic beverage of choice because it's delicious. And we like to foster conversations that happen in bars, not churches or classrooms or fill in the blank. So what are we drinking here today, Kyle?
We're drinking a beer. So some of our listeners are going to be excited about that. Others are going to be disappointed it's not whiskey, but we drink lots of whiskey around here, so it's nice to return to beer. If you recall, back our oldest listeners, the first stuff we drank was beer.
Lots of beer.
We started with that. So I like to bring it back out every now and then. And this is from my favorite brewery. This is from Side Project Brewing in St. Louis, Missouri. And this is a Saison, which is a barrel-aged Saison, which is my favorite kind of beer. I've not had this blend specifically. This is called Cœur de Cuvée. Which is French for something like
so fancy.
Heart of the blend or heart of the batch or something like that. And it is a blend. So what Side Project, their master brewer, is known for mostly is one, his palate, but two, his blending skills.
Mm-hmm.
He came from wine where he developed a really,
cool.
really good palate. But he's just excellent, best in the game at blending. And so this is a blend of lots of different barrel-aged recipes. Some of them were aged for 18 or 19 months in French oak. Some of them were rested for 9 months in different oak. Some of them were aged for 33 months in neutral oak, and they were all then blended and dry hopped.
That's insanity.
Yeah. So some of this is pretty old, especially for beer, and I expect good things. We'll see.
Side Project always brings good things. Cheers.
Cheers.
Lots of pineapple on the nose.
Pineapple.
I can see that.
It's got that sour,
yes,
puckery. Like
you know it's going to be puckery.
Like Granny Smith.
Oh, yes, like a Granny Smith.
Yep.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
This is so good.
That's good. That's really good.
This is better than I expected.
It's really good. Man.
Yeah.
It's hard to narrow down one flavor profile, but you still get the pineapple in the flavor profile. You still get the tart fruit. I don't get as much barn as I usually get in Saisons. This is cleaner.
No. So like a good barrel-aged Saison to me has I'm going to describe it as a gym sock, but it is the best possible version of that kind of flavor.
What's like, a gym sock?
Gym sock, like a like a sour kind of, I don't know, almost bodily thing. But somehow it blends well with everything else.
Man, you just about ruined this for me.
I get a little strawberry on the nose.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
Yeah, Elliot's like, still not drinking, so he's just, he's literally smelling the bottle.
Elliot is whole 30 tasting, which means he's just sniffing.
Gonna stick my nose in this bottle. Snorting
Saison. It could become a thing.
Yeah. One of my favorite things about breweries like Side Project that do regular releases of blends is that each instance is dramatically different from the previous ones.
This is so good.
This is blend 11. I've had several of the previous ones. None of them have been this good of this line, in my opinion.
In the last two tastings, Elliot has been on Whole 30 and is abstaining, which props. But it just so happens that they've been two delicious tastings. It's almost like we're putting it on for him. But
yeah, my bad.
This is the best Saison I've
ever had. I do have another bottle of this, and now that I know how good it is, I'm going to sit on that, I think.
This is the best Saison I've ever had.
It's damn good. I think you said that about the last Side Project Saison.
I haven't had many Saisons. This
one is
educating
better
me
than that, for sure. So, Corey, Side Project, cheers. This is phenomenal.
Cheers to Side Project.
He's never going to hear this, but you did good, buddy.
Around here, we like to read reviews, particularly awesome reviews, and this is a review from Jag4444, and the review is titled, "Well, I just binged listened to every single one of these."
Could have told you a couple to skip.
Yeah.
Right?
Jag quadruple four says, "A spiritual director friend of mine recommended this podcast to me 60 days ago, and I just finished binge listening to every single one. My brain hurts a little, but my epistemic humility has never been higher."
Oh, man.
Cheers.
Kyle's
they
so happy
actually
right
listened.
Now.
I now awesome know that I really don't know that much, but my faith has never been stronger. Currently, my wife and I are in the midst of transition between two very different faith communities, and this podcast has played a significant role in stabilizing these choppy waters for us. Hmm. If you're on the fence about trying this podcast out, then I couldn't recommend more that you take a deep breath, allow yourself to be challenged, and dive in with a willingness to learn. Just maybe don't do it all in 60 days, or else you might need a stiff drink. Actually, if you are listening to this podcast, you are probably already doing that. P.S. Also, if you're not a drinker, don't be afraid of this podcast. I've never tasted alcohol in my life for quite a few reasons and thoroughly enjoyed all of this.
Dude, that's so cool.
How about that?
Can we like use that for something?
I think we should somehow.
We just did?
Yeah.
Can we like, I don't know, of that I'd put on a t-shirt. That's fantastic.
Jack 4444. Cheers to you.
Cheers. So, Randy, this is one of those Christian-y questions, but I mean it sincerely. What does Easter mean to you?
Oh, boy.
Several ways you could take that. How's your experience of Easter changed at all as you've deconstructed over the past few years? If it has, how do you celebrate Easter? What forms of liturgy do you find meaningful, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Easter is very, very meaningful to me. I love resurrection as a theme, right? I mean, resurrection is one of the main reasons why I'm in this thing called Christianity and still like super excited about it, because of the possibility of resurrection after we die, because of the idea of resurrection as a metaphor that works for like living a hopeful life and having hope. So yeah, I love it. I love the scriptures. I love the resurrection stories. They're compelling. They're beautiful. They're radical. They're revolutionary. The tidbits of them, of the significance of the woman in the story coming through right in the forefront, I think says so much that you have to pay attention to it every single time you go into the resurrection stories. Mm. And then Paul's take on the resurrection floor me. And then you add all that to it. I just love Easter services. I love the Easter hymns. I love the life triumphing over death themes. Like, I can't sing an Easter song or hymn without welling up with tears in the best way possible. And then it's just, yeah, I think resurrection is just a beautiful, beautiful theme that's worth spending time on.
Yeah.
How about you?
It's really meaningful to me too. I don't know. I love Christmas, but mostly because of the trappings and like the social aspect of it and hanging out with family around the Christmas tree and whatever. And, incarnation's significant, but Resurrection has always been the thing that gripped me most mm-hmm. about Christianity, mm-hmm. both personally and theologically. And I take Lent very seriously.
Hmm. What does that mean?
For most of my life, I have anyway. I approach it very contemplatively. I try, this has not been true in the last couple of years, if I'm honest, because I've been very busy. But for most of my life, I've tried hard to approach it in the mode of contemplating death, like a mm-hmm. memento mori, as it's supposed to be.
Ash Wednesday themes.
Yes, like, so I would, you know, I would go and get the ash smeared on my forehead and teach that way, you know, and be very open about that, and try to keep death on my mind for those 40 days, and
that's
know,
pretty
listen
morbid.
To things and read things that would remind me of it. And I'm going to ask you later what sorts of, you know, art speaks to you about resurrection and that sort of thing. And so I try to read stuff and contemplate stuff that does that, and various other, you know, disciplines that Christians take up. I've always taken it very seriously, even when I believed hardly anything. Like even when I've had years where it all seems false, I still try to do that. And I think it's definitely the most significant part of the Christian calendar to me. And it's also the part that I have the hardest time reconciling with some things that I wonder about, mm-hmm. about God. Some of them philosophical, some of them personal, and we can get into some of those. I can't say, though, that my experience of it has changed much, interestingly. The more skeptical I've become, mm-hmm. the more tightly I've clung to Easter.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. It may be because it's like the core of it to me, you know? So we've talked a bit before about Christianity still existing without it, mm-hmm. without resurrection. We can come back to that later, but I don't think it can, mm-hmm. and it is the core of the thing to me. And it's the thing that if it isn't so, then all the things I take seriously and put value on are meaningless in some sense. And so the easier it becomes to question all the other stuff, the smaller my center circle becomes.
Yeah.
And it tightens around this thing.
You kind of need the resurrection.
I need it, yes. And that's a weird thing to say for a philosopher, to mm-hmm. need a thing to be true, because that's dogmatism. That's the thing we warn people about, right? But I don't mean that epistemically, although belief is part of it. I mean it viscerally. I mean it spiritually, like in my gut. I need for my mother's polio to not have been meaningless, for example, right? So stuff like that. I need for my friend who's currently being treated for cancer I need for that to mean something and to be going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, the more deconstructed I get, the more significant that becomes.
Yep. Yeah, no, I would say as well that I've gone through, I'm not going to say deconstruction, even though probably I could put myself in that camp, but I've gone through a spiritual evolution, and I plan on continuing going through a spiritual evolution to lesser or greater degrees throughout my life. But the resurrection has mostly stayed intact for me. Mm-hmm. And I say mostly, and we'll get to it at the end of the episode, why conversations like this kind of piss me off a little bit.
Okay.
All right. But let's just head into, what is the resurrection?
Yeah.
Does it make sense? Let's ask the questions.
Yeah, yeah. So what do Christians mean by resurrection? Because lots of very serious theologians and biblical scholars have spilled a lot of ink on distinguishing resurrection from other kinds of afterlife views in other religions, or even in like early Christian sects and, you know, Gnostics and all the other stuff, the people that interpreted what Jesus was differently, they all had different views. And then this sort of orthodox view of resurrection formed, just like it did for all the other big, you know, core theological doctrines like mm-hmm. the Trinity and whatever over the first few hundred years of the church. I'm not a church historian, but like they solidified their views about this stuff. So when Christians talk about the resurrection of Jesus and the future resurrection of, you know, the world, what do they mean?
Well, I was just going to ask you the same question.
But I asked first, so now you have to answer.
I mean, it's like the most kindergarten question, I feel like, in many ways that, you know, Jesus... I don't think you can divorce the resurrection from Jesus' life and death, obviously, mm. right? So Jesus, I would say, in his life, death, and resurrection, in my current theological framework, conquered all that held humanity back and set itself against God's beloved, which is all human beings. which is biblically sin, death, and the power of the devil. Whether or not you think the devil is real or not, we're going to have an episode about that coming up, I think, sometime soon. Mm. But I think biblically it's pretty obvious that there is something holding humanity back from union with God. I think that's the main thing, and from having life. And Jesus, in his life, death, and resurrection, conquered all those things. And the resurrection just means, I think, theologically, that Jesus is the ultimate victor over all things.
Yeah.
You know, Paul says that God is going to be all in all. Like, Jesus is going to hand over the keys to the kingdom to the Father because he has supremacy over all things. This is 1 Corinthians 15. And so I think the reason that a person like Paul, an ancient person like Paul or myself could say, this is why the resurrection is the most important thing in the universe's history, is that if it's true, it means that Jesus is supreme over cancer and polio and injustice and oppression, and will have the final say, like good and beauty and life win in the end. That's, yeah. I think, the theme of resurrection and why it matters so much.
Yeah, good. So it's automatically theologically, or suffused with theological significance,
yes.
Right? It's not divorced from Jesus' teaching. It's not divorced from the Jewish context of Jesus' teaching. It's all one thing. N.T. Wright is excellent on this. I'm sure we're going to talk about
good.
Him more because he's had a lot to say about this. Yeah, and so I love that. Thank you for immediately pointing that out. But it's also concrete,
sure.
Right? Like, uncomfortably so from the perspective of liberal religious people,
sure.
And from the perspective of other kinds of faith traditions who approach the afterlife differently, it is specific and
historic.
It's grounded in a moment, like mm-hmm. in history, a person who lived and who made some claims and then who died. And then there were witnesses to that person's life who wrote about it, who claimed that they saw him again. Like, these things are, and I'm starting to sound like my old apologist self, but like, this is core to the Christian story. It's not it's not presented as a metaphor.
Yeah. One of my favorite, just as an aside, one of my favorite verses in the resurrection narrative is the, you know, Matthew, I think 28, Great Commission is just about to happen. Jesus is just about to ascend. And it said, Jesus' followers gathered up on this hill. He was about to ascend. And it said, most of his followers saw him and believed, though some still doubted.
Yeah.
Which is so fun to me.
I know.
Like, you're standing there looking at the resurrected Jesus, mm-hmm. and they're like, I don't buy it.
Yeah, it's an actor, probably.
Nah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is. And it's amazing it's in the text,
good
right?
For
it's amazing
that
Thomas is in the text, you know, that that great old Caravaggio painting with Thomas sticking his finger in Jesus' side. Like, that's a thing they decided to put in there.
And that's one of the reasons why I love the scripture so much. And it helps me believe it, actually.
Yeah.
That it actually says, hey, just so you know, some doubted, didn't believe this.
Yes. So I think it's important to be clear on the radicalness of the thing we're celebrating at Easter, and how, not counterintuitive, counterintuitive is far too weak a word, how
fantastical?
Magical almost. Kierkegaard would call it offensive. It offends reason. It's almost incoherent. We can talk about that. Yeah.
What did Kierkegaard think about the resurrection?
It's the focal point. Well, okay, so incarnation itself is the focal point, but you can't really separate them, right?
Yes,
because the incarnation had a terminus, if you will, or like a crux, if we want to be very, you know, literal about it, Lutheran about it, and that was the cross. And then, of course, you can't have the cross without what happened next. So it's all kind of one thing, and it's the thing that your reason runs up against and fails, and then you have a choice for Kierkegaard.
Okay.
Am I going to accept this in hope and live accordingly, or am I going to reject it in despair?
And he accepted it in hope.
He did. Or at least he encouraged us to. So it's not resuscitation, right? We're not talking about somebody who wasn't actually dead.
Mm-hmm. Or they were dead for 15 minutes or
exactly.
5 minutes.
Yeah, or even hours, right? Mm-hmm. It's this very concrete, very falsifiable, at least for the people there, kind of claim. And the whole thing is hung on it. And when Paul, you talked, I'm going to get you to say a little bit more about Paul's view of resurrection and what you like about it. But he minces no words, man. He hangs the whole thing on it and talks about how it is offensive to reason. He uses his own phrase for that. But it's like, it's the sort of thing God would do to create a stumbling block for those who are confident in their own ability to get to the truth. And I think that's part of what he had in mind there. So going into this, because I'm going to air my skepticism here in a few minutes.
Sure.
And I've said simultaneously that this is the most important aspect of this whole thing to me, and that my life would in many ways be meaningless without it. And also, I find it extraordinarily difficult to believe, and sometimes straightforwardly don't believe it. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to hold those in tension, because it is a tough thing to believe. And if you think it's not, you just haven't thought hard enough about it. And I'm going to try to convince you of that. I'm going to raise some objections that maybe will help. But
yeah, no, yeah. And I mean, I don't think you'll have to convince me that it's, well, a tough thing to believe is a loaded gun, because when you grow up in a faith,
oh, yes.
you take something
yes.
for granted.
Yes.
It becomes very ironclad, and certainty is wrapped all around that thing.
Yep.
When you disassemble and deconstruct that certainty, then all of a sudden it becomes vulnerable.
Yeah.
However, after you go,
okay.
I'm going to tell everyone why I'm frustrated with conversations like this
okay.
because of what it does
Good.
To me.
Before I do that, though, you want to say anything about Paul and what jazzes you about in his view of resurrection?
No, I just like, Paul's a really smart guy, and he makes really, really brilliant arguments a lot of times. And I think some of, like, I think he really caught on to the scandal of Christ in ways that most human beings don't. Mm-hmm. And that is that he realizes the silliness of like an itinerant preacher walking through Galilee, being from an unimportant place, having no like social standing, having no formal education that we know of, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this is the person that is the image of the invisible God and
yeah.
and all of the fullness of the deity dwelling in Jesus. I'm just quoting from Paul here. And then that the way that God accomplishes victory is through a humiliating execution, literally like dying like a criminal, forgotten and scorned and mocked and all the things, and then coming back to life. Like, the whole story is ridiculous in many ways.
Yeah.
And Paul gets that. And that's the, he sees the beauty of that
yes.
scandal. He sees the revolting nature of it, and he's enthralled by it and
yeah.
says, well, yeah, this is the way that God, like, what more beautiful way would God rescue humanity than by the scandalous, revolting, revolutionary story
mm-hmm.
of this common person who we didn't take seriously, but God saw fit to save all things through him.
Yeah, that's good, man. You could preach on that. I bet you have. So I want to ask a couple questions. Does the resurrection make sense? So like, when you think carefully about it, is it the sort of thing that you could intelligibly hope for
mm-hmm.
is what I'm really asking. Can you legitimately, rationally hope for it? And so we've spoken about at length before the end of reason and the failure of reason. And, you know, every time we bring up Kierkegaard, that comes up. But I still have a very high regard for reason. And it is part of human nature, mm-hmm. right? And I think C.S. Lewis said something like this, but I'm not going to remember the quote. It's hard for me personally, and I suspect it's hard for others, to hope for something that I can't understand. Now, let me rephrase that a little bit. It's hard for me to hope for things that seem incoherent.
Sure.
If I just can't see one way or the other, then there's room for hope, I think. There's room for faith in that, and I'm okay with that. And a lot of Christian doctrines are like that. I don't know what the hell the Trinity means. I've read arguments on all sides of it, and none of them seem convincing, and it seems utterly mysterious at the end of the day. But I don't see that it's not meaningful, right? Mm-hmm. I don't see any, like, obvious contradictions. Some people would disagree with me there, but you know, I could have faith in something like that. I could hope for something like that because it doesn't present itself to me as incoherent.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, resurrection does. So one of the things David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, kind of known for his skeptical bent. Yeah, I'm a big fan. Kind of the, you know, one of the main proponents, progenitors of empiricism, which kind of won the day in Western philosophy, at least, continuing into the present. His influence lasted even after Kant's, like, immense influence in response to him. So his critique of miracles and resurrection in particular was enormously influential. It's been influential in my own life. So Hume had part of his argument against miracles is complex, and we're not going to go into it. But part of it is that there's a kind of weight of evidence built up over time from your observations of the world. There's just kind of a way the world proceeds that we become accustomed to, so much so that we don't notice it.
Hmm.
And some of the things that, you know, one of the great values of philosophy is that it can point out things to you
yeah.
about your experience of the world that are jarring because you recognize them for the first time and recognize that you've been taking the opposite for granted for so long,
yep.
or taking something about them for granted. He thought causality was like that, but we won't get into that. So for miracles, part of his argument against the reasonability of believing them, or believing reports about them more specifically, is that everything in our experience tells us they can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is never more true than for resurrection, because the death rate, as they say, is 100%. We see decay and death and entropy around us all the time. We're born dying, literally, in some sense. And so the idea that universal experience could be reversed and overcome forever just wars against our reason, which is rooted in our experience. That's empiricism. And I think that's right. And
yep.
So there is this enormous weight of evidence just from the get-go against the central claim of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
that it needs to overcome in some sense, not to, you know, not in the apologetic way of convincing all the naysayers and silencing the heretics, but just to get it to the place where it seems coherent enough for me to hope for it.
Yeah.
And so there are some philosophical issues that I just want to touch on lightly. We won't go too much into any of them, that make resurrection difficult. It's especially difficult if, like me, you're a materialist. And this means I believe humans are physical. They're physical stuff. We're made of atoms, right? Mm-hmm. We obey the laws of physics. And that is the overwhelming majority view of all philosophers who work on that subject, and has been for quite some time. Some philosophers are dualists. We'll talk about that in a different episode. It's a little bit easier for them, but still not totally easy. But if you're a materialist like me, then it's true that I am a different physical object than I was 10 years ago.
Time out for a second. In like 30 seconds or less, describe what a dualist is.
A dualist is someone who thinks there's both a material and an immaterial part of the human being. You could call the immaterial part a mind or a soul. That's been the most common vernacular, a spirit, I suppose. Almost, there's different kinds of dualism. The most prominent kind historically in the West has been a kind of substance dualism, which says that there is an immaterial substance and a material substance, and the composite of the two creates the human being.
Hmm.
Most Christian dualists have thought that when the body dies, the immaterial part of you continues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing God preserves until the resurrection, when he reclothes it, if you will, mm-hmm. with a new body.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a very Jewish view. It's a pretty heavily Greek-influenced view. Plato was a dualist. So I'm not that.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a separate episode's worth of content to explain why. I think that we're physical stuff all the way down. And what that means is, whatever I am, it cannot be this, well, there are puzzles about what it can be, because this particular physical configuration of atoms is unique. It will literally be different seconds from now. It was different seconds ago. It was different 10 years ago. And somehow I've stayed the same person through that. At least I think I have. Maybe I haven't. Some people would claim I haven't. So the question this raises for resurrection is, if I'm a physical thing and that physical thing dies and decays, and then God, I don't know, makes a new body,
mm-hmm.
how is it me?
Mm-hmm.
Even by omnipotence, how is it me?
I mean, it almost can't be if you're a pure materialist.
Yeah, it yeah. seems that way, doesn't it? And yet even the dualists, all the respectable ones anyway, want to say that you're like intimately connected to a physical body. It's an important part of who you are. This is why Aristotle critiqued Plato's dualism and had his own kind of version of materialism. That's a controversial claim, but it seems more materialist than dualist. And said, you know what? If you're a composite between the two, then without one, you're not you. You're not a human, right? You're not a person. And I think that's right. And so let me read you a quote from a philosopher who is both Catholic and a materialist, giving an analogy about this, okay? Because, you know, it's very tempting to say that, well, God can, if he created you the first time, he can create you the second time and ensure that it's you. And that's a hard thing to believe. Let me read you this analogy. So this philosopher, his name's Peter Van Inwagen, he says, suppose a certain monastery claims to have in its possession a manuscript written in St. Augustine's own hand. And suppose the monks of this monastery further claim that this manuscript was burned by the Arians in the year 457. it would immediately occur to us to ask how this manuscript, the one we can touch, could be the very manuscript that was burned in 457. Suppose their answer to this question is that God miraculously recreated Augustine's manuscript in 458. We should respond to this answer as follows. The deed it describes seems quite impossible, even as an accomplishment of omnipotence. God certainly might have created a perfect duplicate of the original manuscript, but it would not be that one. Its earliest moment of existence would have been after Augustine's death. It would never have known the impress of his hand. It would not have been a part of the furniture of the world when he was alive, and so on. Now, suppose our monks were to reply by simply asserting that the manuscript now in their possession did know the impress of Augustine's hand, that it was a part of the furniture of the world when the saint was alive, that when God recreated or restored it, God, as an indispensable component of accomplishing the task, saw to it that the object God produced had all these properties. We confess we should not know what to make of this. We should have to tell the monks that we do not see how what they believe could possibly be true. The same thing is true, hopefully it's clear from the analogy, of a resurrected body. I simply am this physical thing, and if God were to make another one, it wouldn't be me. So I might be able to, you know, believe in the, you know, the power of omnipotence to create a new thing that has all my memories, but I can't, like, reasonably hope for that future.
I mean, I think it's harder to believe for us because there's people been dead in the ground for, you know, thousands of years. But I think it's less hard to believe because of the empty tomb and Jesus. Like,
right.
God reanimating this dead body, overcoming death, bring it back to life. And then it, you know, says crazy things like going down to exile, hell, and all that stuff. But the empty tomb speaks something differently than this analogy does, I would say.
I suppose, but there's still a worry about, I mean, you could ask the question, was the resurrected Jesus the same person as the Jesus on the cross? Because all the same
Thomas
things
put his
would
fingers
be there.
In the...
Right, but all the same philosophical worries would apply.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you think, you know, I don't know, maybe God's inhabiting that body, this would be totally heretical by, like, the standards of Athanasius, I think. But, like, if God was somehow an exception... and his personal identity was preserved through that, it doesn't give me any hope that mine will be, because I'm not God, right? I'm not an incarnated being. So this is, you know, one of many philosophical worries that questions the coherence of the idea. So it's not just that it is a thing you have to take on faith. That's granted. It's not just that it's a historical event we don't have overwhelming evidence for. That's also taken for granted. It's that the idea itself almost seems incoherent.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the whole thing hangs on this, all of Christianity. And this guy, the philosopher that wrote that, believes it. He's a Catholic, and he's admirably honest about all these things, about, you know, saying when something seems mysterious to the point of incoherence, and nonetheless, you got to choose, and sometimes the alternatives are equally mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what this comes down to for me is the force of the can I hope for this question is really whether when I do hope for it, I'm just hoping for something that I know to be impossible. And that thing is that I won't die.
Mm-hmm.
Because belief in a resurrection, belief in any kind of afterlife really, is a kind of denial of death. At least denial of what all the existentialists meant by death, which is the end of my existence,
mm-hmm.
right? Some of them accused religious people, not without merit, of just denying death at all.
Sure.
Because if I think that I'm either immediately or in some length of time going to be alive in myself again, then did I really die? It was like a long sleep, you know, a kind of interim thing. Death could be defined as the cessation of my consciousness permanently. And again, Hume's point, everything in my experience tells me that's what it is. Except this one thing.
Yeah. Yep. What's interesting to me as you talk, I'm realizing that I think it's easier for me to believe, put my faith in God, in a being that's other or non-being, the ground of all being, you know, any way you want to cut it, that is creator, sustainer, all the biblical words. That's easier for me to believe, actually, than in the afterlife.
Mm.
It makes more sense to me that there's a God behind all of this, an intention behind all of this, a thought and a love behind all of this,
mm-hmm.
than reanimating dead bodies or, you know, taking on different forms. But that doesn't mean that I don't believe in the afterlife. It's just
right.
One is easier to swallow for me than the other.
Yeah, and I have a real hard time separating them.
Sure.
Yeah. Even the ethics, right, which is, I think, the thing you would fall back on if you were a kind of very liberal Christian, for example, or really any kind of religious tradition, and you rejected an afterlife and you did think that death was the end of your existence, and you'd probably find most of the meaningfulness of your religious practice in a kind of embodied an virtue and ethic, yeah. Right? But even the ethics don't make a lot of sense to me without an afterlife.
Hmm.
They seem kind of hopeless on one hand, but also like just they don't work out because they're fueled by and based on a view of God that just doesn't seem to hold if there's not another chance.
Yeah, that's where I disagree.
Okay, well, maybe we should talk more about that sometime because, yeah, it seems to me that even Plato said something like this. I don't know if he believed it, but like a lot of lives end in really just vulgar ways that don't seem to have any meaningfulness at all. And lots of really bad people have great lives and get away with all of it. And if there's not something to balance the scales, at least somewhat,
mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to believe that any kind of ethic about a good life could be based on the character of a God who set things up that way.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So they're not separable to me.
Sure. That's fair. Taking that reading or that exercise that philosopher presented, why do you come back to the resurrection?
Because I have to. There's not a good alternative that is as meaningful to me. I'm sure a lot of it's rooted in my personal history, my autobiography, the people I've known and loved, and the context I was formed in. You know, there are, you know, like versions of Buddhism I could get on board with. Some of them seem to make sense, and I think in significant ways are probably at least partially true. But I wasn't raised a Buddhist. I was raised a Christian, and I was raised with this image of resurrection in front of me. And I've had deeply meaningful experiences with a person I took to be Jesus. And some of those were, you know, related to contemplating resurrection and new life. And so, yeah, I just don't see a good alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, for better or worse, my tradition. And I'm going to grapple with it. And I think everybody has to do that, right? If someone was raised Buddhist or Hindu or whatever, I'm not going to try to compel them to grapple with my issues. They have plenty of their own. And I'm not saying you are obligated to stay in the tradition that you inherited, but I inherited a rich one, and it has as many resources as others. And I'm compelled to see it through.
Yeah. And for me, I do believe the resurrection happened. I do believe that ultimate what we're headed for is resurrection and new creation. If it's not true, though, and I as a pastor have spent lots of time thinking, what if I am spending my whole life on something that isn't true and trying to convince people of it? It's a crazy thing to think about. But I'm convinced in this moment, at least, that a life led that believes in things like resurrection and hope and new life and possibility, and that we're headed somewhere good. The world, the universe, all things, reality is headed somewhere good, which I believe is resurrection. Even if it's not true in the end, that would still be a life well lived. Like I become a better person when I see through the lens of resurrection, when I interact with the world and human beings through the lens of resurrection, because there's unending hope and possibility and goodness around the corner for anything and anyone. Yeah. And I'm a better person when I actually fixate on that and focus on that and try to see that around me, rather than slipping into nihilism, slipping into meaninglessness, slipping into there is no rhyme or reason. You can still be a humanist and live a good life. I know there's other alternatives, but I don't mind, even if I'm fooled and resurrection isn't a thing, Jesus isn't alive, living towards, hoping towards, having faith in resurrection, I'm okay with it.
So let me pose this question to you, because I know you're going to run with it. How is resurrection different from the kind of standard, let's say American, I think it's bigger than American, but like the standard Christian view that I grew up with,
mm-hmm.
of we die and our soul, which is the thing we really were anyway, goes somewhere else. And it's like happy, bliss, joy, wherever that is. And then heaven happens somehow we don't really think carefully about, but it happens out there,
mm-hmm.
and this world burns, mm-hmm. and good riddance.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there's kind of a resurrection, and we don't think too carefully about, you know, what that means other than we're going to be there and the people we hated probably aren't.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be justly dealt with. We talked about that in our last episode if you want to hear more about that. But this idea primarily that, you know, I'm this non-physical thing and when I die, I'm going to go somewhere else and God is going to reward me there.
Mm-hmm.
And this earth is, you know, whatever part of the thing that I'm getting out of.
Yeah, I would say that viewpoint is almost completely non-biblical. And I say almost because there's some parables, you know, where Jesus gives this picture of the rich man and Lazarus and all that stuff, but it's a parable. Okay, first things first. Parables are non-literal. They are trying to point to something that's true and real that uses a picture or a metaphor or an idea to point us to something that's true and real, right?
Yeah.
You take those out of the equation and it's almost completely non-biblical view to think of afterlife as heaven, as this place where we all turn into babies in loincloths and float around and, you know, worship endlessly. A more biblical view of afterlife would be resurrection. And N.T. Wright has done tons of work on this. Mm-hmm. You should check it out.
His book, what is it? Surprised by Hope. That's a good one for this topic.
Yep, for sure. He's completely rooted in the New Testament, talking about how Romans 8 should be foundational text for us when we talk about resurrection and what the next life will be like. And that is, all of creation is longing and groaning as in childbirth for the sons of God to be revealed. That's a text about resurrection, that creation itself has this written into its inner self. That would be kind of dualistic, right? To think that there's a soul or a spirit behind creation even. And this is metaphorically in the Psalms. It's all throughout the scriptures that like the rocks will cry out and that you know, you have that. And then you have Paul in Ephesians 1 saying that God's purpose put into effect in Christ Jesus when all the fulfillment of time had happened is to bring unity in all things on heaven and on earth in Christ Jesus. Now, unity to all things in heaven and on earth, first of all, he mentions earth there. That means that like this world is headed somewhere and it's not headed for probably the furnace. Now, some people are going to object and call into question verses from Revelation. Good luck taking Revelation literally and, you know, concretely. Again, that's a book completely full of symbolism. We're going to have a episode with Scott McKnight, who wrote a brilliant book about Revelation. Stay tuned for that one just in a few weeks. But the majority of the New Testament is pointing towards unity, unification of all things, the restoration of all things. And I think that's what resurrection is a little bit more of a fuller picture biblically and New Testament wise, which is that like renewal, redemption, and restoration is coming, and all things are going to be like there's nothing that this torrent, this huge raging river of resurrection will not affect, from humanity to earth. It's a new heavens and a new earth, but like not divorced or killed of the old one. It's a renewal and a transformation.
Yeah. And let's be clear, N.T. Wright is not some crazy liberal.
No, right.
This isn't just his view, of course. He's just a good modern exponent.
He's as theologically conservative as it gets.
Exactly. And yeah, and he's no materialist either, but the physicality of the resurrection is you can't take it out and still have resurrection, right?
And he does speak, we can't mention N.T. Wright and resurrection without mentioning his work on the historicity of the resurrection.
Right,
he's done great work on kind of showing if the resurrection didn't really happen, this is the early church is an occurrence that we've never seen in humanity's history of the amounts of people who were willing to die, who were first, you know, the first to see it. And then he goes on from there and he makes a really good case, but I'm not going to do that for him. He does it good.
Yeah. So that's in a book called The Resurrection of the Son of God, which is a giant, like 1,000-page tome. If any of our listeners want to pick that up. And it's like part three of a trilogy that the other two parts equally long. Yeah, so that's heady academic stuff. He probably also has a popular version of that. I'm not sure.
And you can look it for a podcast. I've listened to podcast episodes where he goes through it.
There's plenty of those. And he's really good, particularly on the idea of, I think this is the most original part of that take, is the discontinuity of the Jewish view of something you might call resurrection and what developed as the Christian view, how it is kind of an original idea that started with the birth of Christianity and then, you know, caught on. There's something unique about it, in other words. And yes, it's here, right? It's not out there. It's this planet. It's physical, and it has started.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a continuation of something Jesus inaugurated.
Yes, a realized eschatology is what theologians would say.
Exactly. Yeah. So, sorry to those who are excited about leaving the world.
Yeah, that's not in the
Christianity
Bible.
Christianity does not promise that.
Nope. praise the Lord too.
Right. And do something about climate change.
Exactly.
So since we mentioned N.T. Wright, and I'm not lumping him in with this group of people I'm about to describe, but when I was in my apologetics phase, he was definitely someone that was commonly appealed to alongside several others who are more directly in line with kind of evangelical apologetics, particularly about the resurrection, though. There are a few people who have literally made whole careers out of establishing the historicity of the resurrection, particularly with an eye to using it in apologetic arguments and establishing historiographically. I won't name these people, but you can Google them and find out who they are if you want, that the resurrection happened. I myself have made cases like this in blogs that have been deleted for, you know, the resurrection being the most rational explanation of all the historical data points that we have. And now I just don't know that that's a valuable endeavor. So what do you think? Is the resurrection the sort of thing that needs to be proved? Should it have arguments that justify it to non-believers? Is there a place for arguments like that? Easter is always a time when a plethora of new blogs and podcasts along those lines, you know, sermons along those lines come out. Do those things have a place in your view?
Yeah, but in a limited fashion, right? Like, I think they have a place in that if we listen to N.T. Wright give his case for the resurrection, he tells a story of he's got a professor friend who's an atheist who asked him, why do you believe in the resurrection? So he sent him this, basically wrote an essay and went through why he thinks the resurrection is more than likely a historic event. Yeah. And he said that his colleague, and I trust N.T. Wright's not lying, he said his colleague said, you make a really good case. As a matter of fact, I could go along the logic of it. I just choose not to. I choose not to believe.
Yeah.
You know, so that's encouraging to me as a Christian who wants to believe in the resurrection, that you can set it up and you can follow the breadcrumb trail and it leads you to like not being crazy for believing in the fact that Jesus is alive. I like that. But where I said it in a limited fashion, I would never want to base my faith in the resurrection off of approvability of the resurrection, because then I might as well throw it out right away. I think it's a hopeless endeavor. Like, we're never going to be able to prove the resurrection of Jesus. And so I think those are fun exercises. They're worth considering. It's fun considering the perhaps the logic of it and make sense of the early church and why people like Peter suffered crazy deaths because of, you know, perhaps the resurrected Jesus that he saw him. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to faith. And I think it's a dangerous proposition to that faith if you make the provability or the historicity of it rest on everything, because then it's no longer faith. Then we're dealing with certainty and your faith is going to flame out.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're never going to understand it, you know.
Nope.
And the very dangerous thing about this kind of apologetics is, and I don't want to take, you know, too far afield on that topic, but it happens as much with the resurrection as anything else, is reading the people who work on that, who can be very convincing, right? They're often quite smart and are good at stringing arguments together and selecting the evidence that best supports those arguments. And a lay person can come away from those things being overly confident. We've talked about that before, being really convinced that the evidence must surely point in this direction, and really never have any idea of all the counterarguments. Unless they seriously search for them, they're going to get the counterarguments via the people who are critiquing them, right? And they're never going to quite understand why the vast overwhelming majority of people who have thought carefully about all the same sources of data and evidence and argument disagree. And they're going to chalk it up to some kind of lack of faith, or they're going to chalk it up to some kind of, you know, secular bias of scholarship that doesn't want to countenance the possibility of anything supernatural or something like that. I mean, that's unfortunate, right? Because it's just not true. You just talk to some historians who don't believe in a resurrection, some experts in the specific times, and even experts in the biblical text themselves who don't, and you'll see that it's not just a failure of faith, right, or a failure to understand the argumentation. It's something quite different. It's legitimate, reasonable disagreement. So that's one worry with it. Another is the Kierkegaardian worry of, even if you approach this in the best possible way, your reason is, it's just a risky way to approach something as central and significant as the resurrection. If the point of it is faith, you started out your description of it at the beginning of this episode in a theological way, and I think it's exactly the right way to frame it. And if the point of it is a decision that we call faith, then what good is approaching it evidentially going to get you?
Yes.
Is it going to help? Is it going to hinder it? Is it going to make it harder to have faith? And I think it might. Some of the stuff we talked about with Kierkegaard and contemporaneity is related to that. Like, if I really believe that Jesus is as present to me as he was to Thomas or to whoever, then yeah, what is all that historiographical work going to get me at the end of the day, other than feeling a little better about how it stacks up next to all the other religious options or irreligious options, all of which are kind of weird, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe the one shred of this apologetic take that I have left in me is that nobody really has any idea about the afterlife, and the Christian version of it isn't that much weirder than any of the other ones, including the atheist ones, by the way, guys.
Interesting.
Like you guys think you're going to like become, I don't know, part of a tree or something. And like, that's fine, but it's strange. Like if you think carefully about consciousness, just kind of coming online in this part of the universe for no apparent reason, and then I guess just extinguishing, or if you're some kind of Buddhist maybe, or panpsychist, continuing in some other way. Mm-hmm. It's weird.
It's weird.
And we have no explanation for it. Mm-hmm. We can't rule out any of the religious takes either. So,
yep, that's good.
There are no non-weird options, I guess. That's
I like
what
that.
I'm saying.
Yep.
So, Randy, earlier you said this kind of conversation frustrates you, kind of annoys you. Why?
Yeah, it's not this conversation. I appreciate this conversation to an extent.
as far as you can appreciate any conversation with me.
No, probably this one a little less, just a little bit. No, but there's two camps that annoy me, one in particular, and it's the fundamentalist Christian camp in their approach to this, and it's all wrapped up in certainty, and it just drives me absolutely bonkers. Mm-hmm. To take anything about our faith with certainty, I think, is completely nonsensical. We've talked about it ad nauseum, but those are the kind of Christians that make me closer to losing my faith, because it's like that kind of certainty, that kind of belief is just nonsensical. Mm-hmm. And trying to make it logical, sensical, provable, certain is an exercise in futility. Like, I'm smart enough to see that, right? Mm. And so I think the arguments for, the apologetics for the resurrection just drives me absolutely bonkers, and it drives me away from faith. On the same kind of a similar note, these philosophical conversations that talk about how if you're a materialist, resurrection can't happen, it's an impossibility, it's an absurdity. Those kind of conversations, I think, have their place. Like, we need to be rational human beings. We need to be logical. We need to pursue the truth to the end as far as we can. But there's a point where I get to where I feel like the mix of a grumpy old man and a kid, in the better sense of just saying, leave me alone. I like believing in the resurrection. And I mean that sincerely, actually.
Yeah.
I hope these kind of conversations don't exist within my world forever, in that like I'm like all of my faith rests on these conversations. There comes a point where I just enjoy believing in the resurrection. Mm-hmm. I legitimately do. I enjoy believing that there's more possible. I enjoy believing that hope in new creation and the world's headed somewhere good, all the things that I've said throughout this episode, I really enjoy believing in them. I really enjoy hoping that we're headed towards that. And there can come a point when these conversations aren't productive for me anymore, where they hinder and kind of mute my faith in ways that I don't want it muted.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, I want to sit in this like tension, in this in-between place of saying, I know that I want to be able to talk with a philosopher and have a lot, you know, rational conversation with them and consider all the reality of the situation, while also saying, yeah, but I still believe it.
Yeah.
And I don't care.
Okay. Yeah, I'm of two minds about that, because it really depends on the source. Like, I had students with a very similar attitude who had not earned it.
yes.
And that I'm not okay with, pedagogically. But that's not you, right? I know where you're coming from there. I know you're aware of the difficulties.
I am.
And I'm totally okay, I think, at this moment, I'm okay with that, like, psychological, you know what? This makes me happy. I'm not hurting anybody. It makes sense of a lot of things. I'm going to believe this.
And it is that. And it's just also, I don't think I'm ever going to get to a point where I can say this is logical, historical,
right.
Verifiable, all that. I don't think I'm going to get to that place. But I also don't think I'm going to get to a place, I don't know, but I don't think I'm going to get to a place where I let the logic of that conversation of Augustine's burned up manuscript say, yeah, you know what, that's right, I don't believe in the resurrection.
Right.
I might. But in this moment, and after having a lot of conversations with people like you, mostly with you, my faith still stands. And I'm thankful for it. And I want to have these conversations while embracing and holding to mystery. Because I think that you have to as a human. I think you have to become comfortable with mystery, uncertainty, wonder. We're not going to be able to explain existence until, you know, like we're talking about big, big stuff. And I like choosing faith. It actually is. It's why I'm a Christian. It's because I choose hope over despair. I choose to believe in life over death. I choose to believe in resurrection over decay. I choose it happily and wholeheartedly while knowing I don't know.
Do you really believe in the resurrection if you don't live it in some way? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to live it?
Yeah, no, that's a question that I like talking through. Obviously, you can believe in something and just let it be and sit off to the side. You can do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. But do you really believe it, I think? Like you emphasized, I think, is the true question. Do you really believe it? So, and here's the deal. Can you believe in the resurrection and support the death penalty?
Hmm.
Can you believe in the resurrection and be excited that you're dirty, rotten sinner of a neighbor who's gay is going to burn in hell? Can you believe in the resurrection and be completely fine with violence, grotesque, nasty, useless, meaningless violence?
Mm-hmm.
I could go on down the list, right? Can you believe in the resurrection and support politicians who advance policies of death? Can you believe in the resurrection and give up on relationships?
Hmm.
I could do this all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the answer is kind of no.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, by kind of, I mean like millions of people say they believe in the resurrection and support all that stuff. However, I don't think there's as much integrity to it. I think if we are really people of the resurrection, and that's the thing, do we just believe in it, or are we people of the resurrection?
Right.
Do I embody the resurrection? Do I live out the resurrection? Do I see resurrection around me? Do I want to orient my life around the possibility and the idea and concept of resurrection? Do I want to not give up on people? Do I want to not give up on people groups? Do I want, you know, I think this is what it means to believe in the resurrection, is to be a people of resurrection who embody it. Brian Zahn calls it being trailers for the resurrection and being previews of what the resurrection will look like. That's what it means to be a Christian to me.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
No, that resounds with me deeply. That's very powerful. Yeah, it's difficult to imagine what a life like that would look like in practice. I mean, we can point to exemplars who have come close. It's difficult to imagine like a mundane version of it, though, because all of our exemplars are just like almost larger than life.
What do you mean by mundane? Like normal?
Yeah, like not Mother Teresa.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Or not, I don't know, pick your current favorite great person who's clearly like
Shane Claiborne,
bringing life from death
in
very concrete, measurable ways. Or at least even just being present in the suffering and death of others, which is a lot of what Mother Teresa did, and a lot of what Shane does, as far as I understand it.
Living out your faith with integrity, letting it affect everything about
you. You know, somebody with me, like me with a job, you know,
and
a normal, you know, American person, like, yeah, what is embodying the resurrection other than, you know, not supporting all the kinds of policies and stuff you were describing and maybe trying to vote a little better, right? I can do that. But yeah, more concretely than that, I guess, what does a resurrection-centered life look like for someone who is not, like, on the track to be a saint?
right. Well, I mean, saints would probably tell you that, like, it's a lot more common than you or I would ever imagine.
Perhaps, yeah.
But, and I'll hold to that, actually, but I think there's a way of interacting with the world, all of the world, the earth, human beings, family, church, workplace, all of it. I think there's a fundamentally different way of interacting with the world around you that reflects the resurrection in like really small ways, but I can notice them in myself. That's all I can say, is that I can notice in myself when I choose to fixate and to imagine resurrection and what that looks like in my world. I feel more hopeful substantially. The trees and the world around me actually takes on more meaning when I think and believe in and lean into resurrection. Like Paul is saying in Romans 8, all of creation longing for the sons of God to be revealed. Human beings have more possibility to me when I kind of lean into the resurrection. Interactions become a little bit less meaningless. Yeah. Like there's all sorts of ways in which like my mundane life, like you're talking about, becomes a little bit less mundane if the resurrection's true.
Yeah. That's good. So one thing that we're going to try to start doing around here is asking specific questions or maybe having specific parts of our conversation just for our Patreon supporters, just because we're super grateful for them.
Love them.
So I'm going to try to start building into the outline each time.
Cool.
A thing just for you guys. So if you're a Patreon supporter, stick around for the answer to the next question, which is going to be, what has been the most meaningful Easter experience that you've had? If you're not a Patreon supporter, become one if you want to hear the answer to that question. So to close this last question, is there any art or music or anything meditative that is especially meaningful to you about Easter or Lent or getting you in the mood of Good Friday or anything like that that you want to recommend? My favorite, the album that I return to every year since it came out, is Sufjan Stevens' Carrie and Lowell album. The whole thing is about death and resurrection. I don't know if that was intentional, but that's what it's about, and it's gorgeous and sublime, and everyone should go listen to it.
That's fun. I want to like Sufjan more than I do.
Sufjan's a discipline for me. To be fair, I felt that way for a few years. This album absolutely clinched it for me. I was already kind of liking him, but this one really did it. So give it a shot.
Cool. No, I absolutely will. I would just say no. I mean, there's no art that's like caught me off guard and taken my breath away. Music does it for me. Like music is that art form that does it. So the classic hymns, Christ the Lord is risen today, I know that my Redeemer lives. And then there's the new ones, Hillsong, even though we crapped all over him in a previous episode. There's some righteous songs about the resurrection.
Yeah, they do some stuff well.
Incredible. And good theological songs, you know. So there are some Hillsong songs that get me every time. But I will say, as far as art goes, when I look to pieces of art that speak theologically to me, and not just theologically, but spiritually, it's always Eastern Orthodox icons. It's always art that came out of Eastern Orthodox theology, because they have such a robust theology of resurrection. They have such a robust eschatology, and it's all centered on Jesus conquering all. And Jesus, you know, there's incredible pieces of art of Jesus evacuating hell and taking Ephesians 4 seriously. And Jesus is the ultimate victor. It's Christus Victor all the way through in Eastern Orthodox art, and I love it.
It's cool. I don't think I've ever seen a piece of...
Really?
I mean, I'm sure I have in some cathedral somewhere, but like none of them come to mind. When I think
it's like, it's ornate and colorful and rich and kind of almost embellished. You know what I mean? But it's rich, like, and there's so much symbolism. It's like the Book of Revelation, these icons.
Yeah.
Every little piece of it means something and speaks to something. It's really cool.
Awesome.
And so with all this conversation in mind of thinking about the philosophical stuff and the logical stuff and the illogical stuff and the historical stuff, friends, we just bless you to sit in the mystery of the resurrection and to live out the beauty of the resurrection.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Well, that's it for this episode of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar. We hope you're enjoying the show as much as we are. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and Spotify. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode, if it's good enough.
If anything we said really pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, or if you'd just like to send us booze, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Catch all of our hot takes on Twitter at @PPWBpodcast, at Randy Nye, and at Robert K. Whitaker, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com. See you next time.
Cheers.